and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, October 24, 2024. The UN mission in South Sudan marks the UN Day.
In Eastern Equatorial State, the support of the UN has been crucial in addressing our most pressing challenges, from peace building to health, education, and economic development.
And the African diaspora talks about U.S. elections.
I casted my vote as an absentee ballot. We use a website called FPCA. You fill a form, you sign the form, and it has an address that you mail to.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The special representative of the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan is urging South Sudanese leaders to ensure lasting peace prevails across the country. The UN mission in South Sudan is marking the United Nations Day in Eastern Equatorial State with a call to national government to provide services to millions of people affected by conflict, climate shocks, and extreme food insecurity. Some residents of Eastern Equatorial State capital Torit say UNMISS should continue to support the country. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
United Nations Day reflects the official creation of the United Nations on October 24, 1945. Anthony Wapa, acting head of UNMISS Torit Field Office, who delivered the message of the UN Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says the United Nations Day renews commitments to protect the needs and interests of the present and future generation. He also says UNMISS has been working to address issues of development, conflict, and food insecurity.
Millions of people continue to suffer from conflict compounded by climate shocks and extreme food insecurity. To help tackle those challenges, United Nations Family is working in partnership with the government and the people of South Sudan to ensure peace, security, and sustainable development. As UNMISS, we are doing all we can to prevent violence, build trust, and boost community confidence. Peacekeepers are responding rapidly in conflict hotspots.
Peter Gumbo, the Minister of Legal and Parliamentary Affairs in Eastern Equatorial State, praised the UN for its contribution in supporting communities in the state on several levels.
In Eastern Equatorial State, the support of the UN has been crucial in addressing our most pressing challenges, from peace building to health, education, and economic development. Of course, I know they went through many challenges, including security concerns, lack of infrastructures, continuous local conflicts, mistrust and resistance from some of the local communities. But I would like to concentrate mostly here. The UNMISS, for example, through quick impact projects, opened police posts in the state, constructed and built three maternity wards in Kapoita North, Kapoita South, and Torit counties. They also constructed and built two primary health center units at Kauto in Kapoita East and Magui County. As we reflect on this year's theme, I extend our gratitude to UN for its continued partnership and dedication to our people.
Torit Town residents Joyce Amito Loboya says South Sudan still faces a myriad of challenges and urges the UN to provide more support.
The UN, they are contributing a lot and they are supporting us. When we see South Sudan without UN, will not be good at the moment. We still need them. We still need their support. They really have to do more because when we looked at South Sudan at this moment, we still need a lot of their support so that South Sudan also become a country whereby they can stand alone.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan began as a peacekeeping mission in the country. UNMISS was established on July 8, 2011 by United Nations Security Council Resolution 1996 to keep the peace in South Sudan. In 2013, the mission changed its mandate from peacekeeping to civilian protection following the outbreak of violence in across some parts of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Torit.
The International Monetary Fund is calling on countries to take decisive action to control public debt. The call comes as the debt is set to exceed $100 trillion this year, with many African countries, including South Sudan, at risk of distress. For VOA News, Moses Javierimana reports.
While addressing the press during the meeting of the International Monetary Fund that is taking place in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, Vitor Gaspar, the director of fiscal affairs department at the IMF, said that decisive fiscal policy and structure policy reforms can make a substantial contribution to growth amid souring public debt.
Deficits are high and global public debt is very high, rising and risky. Global public debt is projected to go above $100 trillion this year. At the current pace, the global debt-to-GDP ratio will approach 100% by the end of the decade, rising above the pandemic peak.
In Africa, with emerging market and developing economies, the IMF indicated that countries should try to restrict large government wage bills and safeguard public investment to get debt under control. David Ruseri works with the IMF Fiscal Affairs Department.
The challenge that Nigeria faces, as well as many other countries in the region, there are two. One is very low revenue to GDP ratio. And the second, one trend that we've seen, we are a bit concerned, is that the ratio of the debt service obligation to revenue has been increasing. So for the average low-income country, it's about 15%. It means that basically a large part of revenue in these countries goes to just finance the debt.
African countries are facing significant debt burdens, with over 30 countries either showing signs of debt distress already or with the significant signs of heading into that direction. Yungong Theophilus Jong is a policy manager at the African Forum and Network on Debt and Development, a pan-African civil society organization based in Zimbabwe, working on issues of sustainable debt in Africa.
It's more expensive for African countries to borrow. When you look at the interest rates on bonds, you see that African countries pay about 10% interest rates on the average, compared to just about 0.8 and 25% for countries like Germany and the United States of America. Current challenge with Africa's debt is, you know, is the debt restructuring problem.
African countries are carrying a higher level of debt than before the COVID-19 pandemic, when it was at 61%. Commercial debt in Africa now accounts for 43% of the total debt, up from 20% in 2000. On the other hand, there is good news. According to the World Bank, the structure of African debt has changed considerably, as bilateral debt now represents 27% compared to the 52% in 2000. Moses Avyarimana for Voice of America, Washington, D.C.
From money matters, we go to health issues. One in 200 polio infections lead to irreversible paralysis, and among those paralyzed, 5 to 10% of them die when breathing muscles become immobilized. This is according to the World Health Organization. The group says since 1988, polio vaccines have led to a 99% decrease in cases and prevented an estimated 20 million cases of paralysis in children. And as the world marks World Polio Day today, Thursday, at least 26 countries in Africa, including South Sudan, continue to be affected by the disease. For VOA News, Maureen Ojiambo reports.
Polio is a highly infectious disease affecting mainly children under the age of 5. The virus attacks the nervous system and can lead to spinal and respiratory paralysis and death. According to the World Health Organization, vaccination has prevented at least 20 million cases of paralysis in children. Mandy Cohen is the director for the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia, and a member of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative Oversight Board. She says the CDC remains committed to eradicating the disease in the remaining countries experiencing outbreaks.
It is inspiring to see what we can achieve when we work together. The eradication of polio is within sight, and we must add it to the list of the greatest achievements of mankind. It won't be easy, but making history never is. We have the tools and knowledge to ensure no child is paralyzed by polio again. Together, let's deliver another historic win for humanity and end polio today.
She says World Polio Day reminds us of the important role that polio vaccines play in protecting children's lives and safeguarding public health around the world. WHO says cases have decreased by over 99% since 1988. However, the endemic transmissions of the wild polio virus is still being reported in border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The coordinator for polio eradication program at the Regional Office for Africa, Jamal Ahmed, says it took time for Africa to eradicate the disease.
Eradicating wild polio was not easy. It took the efforts of millions of hardworking community health workers to reach every child and vaccinate every child.
A report by the WHO indicates that due to escalating violence, UN agencies offering humanitarian aid in Gaza have been forced to postpone the third phase of vaccination campaign that is ongoing in many countries across the world. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says current conditions in Gaza continue to jeopardize people's safety and movement in northern Gaza, making it impossible for families to have their children vaccinated.
A minimum of 2 doses of vaccine are needed to interrupt poliovirus transmission. This will only be achieved if at least 90% of all eligible children are vaccinated in all communities and neighborhoods. In this round, children will also receive vitamin A to help boost their immunity. However, escalating violence in the north of Gaza has blocked humanitarian missions from reaching people with food and medical supplies.
With this year's theme being the road to zero polio in Africa, the WHO says Africa has reached significant milestones, including outstanding success of Madagascar, which has gone a full year without detecting circulating variant poliovirus type 1. The regional director for WHO Regional Office for Africa, Mashidiso Moeti, says political commitment, as in Africa, is crucial to the successful fight against the disease. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
From San Francisco, we come back to Washington, where the U.S. State Department today announced sanctions on a top leader of Sudan Armed Forces, Margani Idriss Suleiman. As procurement director of the Sudan Armed Forces, the United States say Idriss led efforts to procure weapons and expand the conflict in Sudan, which has led to more than 11 million Sudanese being displaced. The Sudan Armed Forces have prioritized weapons acquisition, including buying drones from Iran and Russia, rather than heeding to a call for peace. That's according to the U.S. State Department. The deals include a port for weapons exchange with Russia, which has escalated the brutality of the SAF's conflict with the Rapid Support Forces. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Americans living in Somalia perform their civic duties. Find out how after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. In our series on African-born Americans, VOA's Philip Alexio introduces us to a woman who seems to be the queen of all threads, the power of her husband's support and what they want to see in the next U.S. president.
This continuing decline in global internet freedom is largely, you know, driven by a worldwide assault on freedom of expression. We saw people face arrest for expressing themselves online in 3/4 of the countries that we cover in the project. And this year, we also saw a record high in people facing physical violence and retaliation for their online activity.
So does this sort of thing happen more during election season, or is it sort of always ongoing?
It's a great question. I think this is always an ongoing issue. But this year, our report really honed in on the rapid series of elections taking place around the world, including in Africa and places like South Africa and Zimbabwe. And we really observed that these elections have been deepening this crisis. False and misleading claims have sought to undermine the integrity of, you know, elections themselves. And there have been efforts to delegitimize independent fact checkers who are doing essential work to make sure that, you know, people who are voting have reliable information to make informed choices about, you know, their future.
So what are these countries doing? So you look at Zimbabwe, like you mentioned, South Africa. I know you guys studied a number of other countries in Africa. What are some of the tactics being used, and how are people sort of being targeted?
Yeah, we've seen really, you know, a range of tactics, deployed to restrict people's access to information online. Arrests and imprisonment is a really common one in all but one of the countries that we cover in Africa. During this year, we saw people arrested or imprisoned for their online expression. Example of this, last October in Angola, an influencer was sentenced to 2 years in jail and handed a hefty fine for insulting the president in a TikTok video. But increasingly, during the project, we've seen an uptick in the manipulation of the online information space through, you know, the use of pro-government commentators and other pushing online narratives. Zimbabwe is a really prominent example of this, as during their elections last August, state media has really amplified, you know, narratives that discredited, you know, both domestic civil society election observers and international groups who reported on the conduct of the elections.
But there's also been some improvement by some countries, and Zambia in Africa at least was one of them. And when you look at that country or some other countries, what are they doing to actually make things better and cutting down on censorship and control?
Yeah. So Zambia, as you said, saw one of the region's largest improvements, actually the largest improvement globally this year. This was really driven by space opening up for online activism. So, you know, although there's certainly a lot further to go, and, you know, we continue to see some concerning arrests of people for, you know, insulting the president or for other concerning issues. Zambian civil society has really led the way in pushing back against repressive measures. They've advocated for the reform of problematic cybercrime laws and took the regulator to court recently after instituted new requirements to collect, you know, facial photos in SIM card registration. So civil society's advocacy and mobilization online has really been a driver of these improvements.
And when it comes to generative AI, I know we spoke with Freedom House earlier, and the idea was that at least in the United States, really wasn't a problem, even though people use it. It didn't have much of an influence or much of an effect on people. But is that the case in other countries who try to use generative AI?
Yeah, it's a really important question. You know, in our research this year, we did see generative AI being used frequently to create false or misleading content, you know, around elections in particular. We had an example, examples in South Africa of deepfake videos of celebrities, you know, endorsing particular political parties. One, I think, really important caveat, in talking about generative AI and its impacts on elections is that we just don't yet understand the technology's, you know, impact and whether it is making influence operations more persuasive. There's still a really major research gap in this area how we can assess and study the kind of effectiveness and full impact of these campaigns.
Is everyone susceptible to getting in trouble, arrested, whether it's activists, it could be a blogger, it could be a politician, a journalist, it could really be anybody. Is there any one group that tends to be in danger more than the other or not?
Yeah, I think journalists and activists, and human rights defenders, their work holding, powerful people to account, I think can, definitely put them at risk. But, more and more as countries are continuing to tighten, controls on and restrict freedom of expression, we're seeing this impact ordinary users. In one example from this year, a teacher in Kenya who made a post in a Facebook group about just the quality of roads in his county was later abducted and beaten, and just really goes to show the brutal consequences that can come from these global trends, and that really anyone is at risk.
Elizabeth Sutherland, thank you very much. Researcher from Freedom House, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Phil.
Some Somali Americans living in Somalia are closely monitoring the U.S. presidential elections, focusing on foreign policy and investment in Africa, while participating by casting absentee ballots. Reporter Abdelghadir Zubair spoke to two of them in the capital, Mogadishu, and has this report with Abdulaziz Osman, narrated by Anthony Lobruto.
Mohamed Dahir Farah leads the Somali American Network Association, or SANA, an organization that fosters connection between Somali Americans and Somalia. A decade ago, he returned to Somalia from the U.S., but remains involved in American politics, staying informed about the country's ongoing political debates. Farah describes the absentee voting process as straightforward.
I casted my vote as an absentee ballot. We use a website called FPCA. You fill a form, you sign the form, and it has an address that you mail to this form, and you're good to go. That's the instruction and the direction we received from the embassy in Somalia and Kenya, both. I did it a month ago, and I believe everything is set.
Farah says that Somalia faced challenges due to shifts in U.S. foreign policy, particularly regarding security aid. Drawing from his experiences both as a Somali American and his role within his community, he said that he is concerned that a new administration may not continue to support Somalia's counterterrorism efforts.
Foreign policy, in terms of security, one experience I had during my time in Africa or Somalia as an American and also as the head of Somali American Network Association is how the Somali government suffered when the security support has been cut by the U.S. Government. It was during Trump time, I remember.
Farah said that around 4,000 Somali Americans currently live in various regions of Somalia, with many serving as business owners, consultants to the Somali federal government, and employees of international organizations. Among them is Mohamed Aden Dini, a human rights activist and Somali parliament member based in Mogadishu. He says a key issue expats in Africa during this election is the need for the U.S. to maintain its investments in Africa and strengthen relations with African nations.
In Africans, they expected that the United States will do a lot of investment. So when you talk to the grassroots and also the African people who are African descent, American people who are African descent, they also want to see U.S. to invest more in African continents.
In a recent interview with VOA in Mogadishu, U.S. Ambassador to Somalia, Richard Riley, said the U.S. is Somalia's largest donor and security partner, providing tens of billions of dollars over the years in personnel, equipment, and funding. Praising the contribution of Somali Americans in the U.S. and also of those who have returned to Somalia to rebuild their homeland.
We're very proud to have over 150,000 Somalis who've come to our country. They're an enormous benefit to our country and to your country. Many have come back to help build the nation here. So we're delighted that they are here. They are participating. So I would say maintain the hope. It's very important, and it's real.
Despite being thousands of miles away from U.S. elections, Somali American expats not only cast their votes for their second home in the U.S., but also play a role in the growth and stability of their homeland, Somalia, bridging both worlds and shaping the future. for Abdul Qadir Zubair in Mogadishu, Somalia, and Abdulaziz Osman, Anthony Libruto, VOA Africa.
And here in the United States presidential campaign, there is little to agree on between supporters of Kamala Harris and supporters of Donald Trump. From Southern California, Ginia Dulot brings us the story of two people selling rival campaign merchandise who are trying to lower the political temperature of their customers.
When California Democrat Sandra Roby saw a booth selling Donald Trump merchandise, she was frustrated by her party's low visibility in the community and decided to open a Kamala Harris booth.
Up until relatively recently, we did not promote our political beliefs out loud. It was something you just kept close to your heart and you lived respectfully amongst each other. But when Trump entered the stage, it all changed. It became kind of like World Federation Wrestling or a sports team, and we could no longer be invisible.
Orange County, California is a solidly Republican enclave in this overwhelmingly Democratic state. Republicans Elvie and Eddie Pantig don't like the Harris booth.
We don't want that.
You don't want them together, side by side?
No.
Why not?
Well, you know, Orange County is supposed to be Republican, you know. And side by side is, you know, and one, maybe another corner, you know, separate.
In a separate corner, but not together.
California Republican Steve Lawrence runs the Trump merchandise booth. He says there was a bit of tension with Roby at first, but they eventually agreed to share the space.
Just because I'm Republican and she's Democrat, there's no reason that we can't coexist here in the same location. We have different feelings, different opinions about things. Certainly people wear their emotions on their sleeves, but, you know, we don't need to have hate that comes into the political views of both parties. We can coexist without having to be so meanful about it.
Democrat Susan Johnson says having the two stalls side by side is a good idea.
I think it's really smart. You know, I think if people just get down and, you know, talk to each other, that they can find a whole lot more in common.
Republican Zaid Habaibi says the stalls show Americans can get along without always agreeing.
This is the freedom that I speak out my mind and I tell what I believe in. I follow the, you know, the democracy regulations in this country. In the meantime, the other party can do as well.
Roby and Lawrence say they have become friends over the last few months and watch out for each other to make sure they're both safe. They say their sign, "We both ask, please be nice," helps lower their customers' political temperatures. Genia Dulo, VOA News, North Tustin, California.
And that's all we have been working on for you this Thursday, October 24th, 2024. When I'll leave you with Khalid and the song Aisha.
J'ai dit Aïcha, prends tout est pour toi. Voici les perles, les bijoux. Aussi au retour de ton cou. Les fruits bien mûrs au goût de miel. Ma vie, Aïcha, si tu m'aimes.
We've been listening to Khalid and the song Aisha. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.